This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether instead directed by political pressure or intimidation.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell pushes back on a Justice Department probe of the central bank.
It's Monday, January 12th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Juana Summers. The death toll is soaring in Iran amid a government crackdown on demonstrators. Will President Trump order military action against Tehran?
We're looking at it very seriously. The military is looking at it. And we're looking at some very strong options.
Also, conservative groups have led talking points on aging and shrinking populations. Now some liberal scholars say it's time to offer progressive solutions.
If progressives don't want to talk about it and self-censor, etc., then no one is going to talk about things that might impact progressives.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Minnesota and the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul are suing the Trump administration over the use of federal forces for an immigration crackdown there. It comes after an immigration agent shot and killed a woman in her car last week. Minnesota Democratic Attorney General Keith Ellison says the federal government is unlawfully commandeering state resources.
We allege that the obvious targeting of Minnesota for our diversity, for our democracy, and our differences of opinion with the federal government is a violation of the Constitution.
Local officials are asking the federal court to halt or limit the immigration enforcement surge. The Department of Homeland Security says it has made more than 2,000 arrests since the current crackdown began. President Trump says Iran has reached out to negotiate with the U.S. It comes as nationwide anti-government protests are roiling the country. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports.
Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One that the U.S. could meet with Iranian officials and that a meeting is being set up. But he cautioned that the military is also looking at, quote, some very strong options. Trump said if Iran attacks U.S. assets in the Mideast, they will be met with a very powerful force. Iranian authorities have cut off internet across the country for 4 days now in a bid to stifle protests that they say are being stoked by, quote, terrorists. Rights groups estimate that hundreds of protesters have been killed in the demonstrations that began December 28th. Iran says security personnel have also been killed. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, repeated the government's position that foreign elements are fueling the violence. The government planned rallies in support of the regime Monday. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
With President Trump's incursion into Venezuela, it can feel like the Republican Party is back to the early 2000s foreign policy of neoconservatism and regime change. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports on how the GOP has evolved.
In the George W. Bush era, neoconservatives believed that exporting U.S. values like liberal democracy and human rights justified regime change in Iraq. U.S. fatigue with that war lessened Americans' appetite for interventionism. When Trump won the presidency in 2016, advocating against foreign entanglements, it was viewed as a rebuke of the neocons. His attack on Venezuela suggests his views have changed since then, but foreign policy experts tell NPR that his staff simply enables his foreign policy instincts far more than in his first term. Trump's foreign policy this term has not been driven by high ideals like neoconservatism. Rather, it's about power and resources, like Venezuela's oil. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says the Department of Justice has served the central bank with subpoenas and threatened it with a criminal indictment. The subpoenas relate to his testimony this summer about the Fed's building renovations. Trump has repeatedly attacked the independent agency for not cutting its key interest rate as sharply as he prefers. Wall Street edged up to more records today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Officials say over 100,000 people in El Paso were left with little to no water after a main break, and it could take until midweek for operations to return to normal. The break in the 36-inch water main line happened over the weekend in the border city, which has a population of about 700,000. A new meta-analysis finds exercise is as effective as antidepressants and therapy to treat depression. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on what type of exercise is effective.
Researchers evaluated evidence from 73 randomized controlled trials that included about 5,000 people with depression. Dr. Stephen Matika of Inspira Health says the new review confirms just how effective exercise can be.
We know that exercise is one of the most evidence-based tools for improving mood.
Exercise mirrors some of the effects of medication and can boost feel-good compounds in the brain, including serotonin, dopamine, and endorphins. The review finds light to moderate activity, including a brisk walk, walk can be just as effective as more intense exercise. And they found the combination of aerobic exercise and strength training appears to be more effective than cardio alone. Alison Aubrey, NPR News.
Muhammad Ali is being honored with a commemorative U.S. postage stamp. Ali was known as one of the greatest boxers and a cultural icon. Ali's wife, Lani Ali, expresses excitement about the tribute, highlighting Ali's mission of spreading compassion. The lengthy process of creating the stamp began after Ali's death in 2016. Ali's legacy as a fighter, activist, and humanitarian continues to inspire the world. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
It's 4:06. We're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up, a profile of the Federal Reserve Chair, Jerome Powell. In our weather, we have a chance for mixed precipitation, steady temperatures in the low to mid-30s tonight. South winds 5 to 10 could gust up to 20, and that chance of rain mixed with snow tomorrow again, 35 to 38, cooling down tomorrow night, 3 to 10 above.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Juana Summers. For years, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has studiously avoided getting dragged into fights with President Trump. But after serving as the president's punching bag, Powell's own gloves are now coming off. The shift comes after Powell says the Justice Department threatened a criminal indictment over the central bank's building renovation and Powell's own testimony on the subject. In a video statement late Sunday, Powell accused the administration of trying to bully the Fed into lowering interest rates.
This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether instead monetary policy will be directed by political pressure or intimidation.
Powell's tough talk signals a new era in relations between the White House and the Fed. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Jerome Powell is the epitome of the diplomatic central banker. Unlike many of his predecessors at the Fed, Powell never trained as an economist. As he told graduates at his alma mater, Princeton, last spring, his parents wanted him to study economics, but he thought it was boring.
Rather than studying, I had spent my freshman year with fellow campus musicians playing my Martin D35 acoustic guitar. It was a high school graduation present and one that my parents surely regretted.
Powell still plays guitar and is a devoted music fan. He made a splash a few years ago when he was photographed at a Dead & Company concert just outside Washington.
It was terrific. What can I say? I've been a Grateful Dead fan for 50 years.
Powell grew up in the nation's capital and knew he wanted a career that combined public service with work in the private sector. He served in the Treasury Department during the first Bush administration, then made a lot of money in investment banking and private equity. His net worth is estimated between $20 and $55 million. During the Obama administration, Powell served as an informal ambassador to Republicans on Capitol Hill and help persuade them not to bust the federal debt ceiling. Obama rewarded Powell with an appointment to the Fed's governing board. He was later promoted to chairman by President Trump. While Powell's a Republican, he carefully courts support from lawmakers in both parties. He told a gathering of business reporters last year that's one reason he usually wears neckties in a neutral shade of purple.
We are strictly non-political. I can't stress that enough. It's not that we're bipartisan. We are non-political. We don't do that. And so purple is a good color for that. That's all. Plus, I like purple ties.
Powell's nearly 8 years as Fed chair have seen both soaring unemployment during the pandemic and later the highest inflation in four decades. Nevertheless, Powell's won praise for his handling of those challenges from other central bankers, like Christine Lagarde of the European Central Bank.
I think I speak for myself, but I speak for all colleagues on the panel. I think we would do exactly the same thing as our colleague Jay Powell does. The same thing. Right?
Yes.
Of course, Lagarde and most other central bankers from developed countries have never faced the kind of relentless pressure campaign that Powell has endured from Trump, who wants much lower interest rates. During his first term, Trump suggested Powell was a bigger threat to the U.S. than Chinese President Xi Jinping. Until now, the Fed chairman has generally refused to take the bait. But as longtime Fed watcher David Wessel of the Brookings Institution told Morning Edition, the Justice Department's criminal probe was the last straw.
It looks like they just pushed Jay Powell too far, and he came out with all guns blazing. It's very unusual, and it's particularly unusual for him. He's been very careful not to antagonize directly the president, and that era is over.
Public service sometimes requires standing firm in the face of threats, Powell said yesterday, channeling the advice he gave those Princeton graduates last spring.
50 years from now, you'll want to be able to look in the mirror and know that you did what you thought was right in every part of your life. At the end of the day, our integrity is all we have. Guard it carefully.
Powell's term as Fed chairman runs through May. He has the option to stay on the Fed's governing board for another 2 years. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Birth rates are falling in the U.S. and around the world. As families shrink, researchers say it means big changes for economies and whole societies. Most of the public discussion around this population shift is being shaped by conservatives, but some progressive groups and mainstream experts say it's time for a broader discussion about a future with fewer children. NPR's Sarah McCammon and Brian Mann report.
When Brian and I first started looking at this shift toward smaller families, we found a lot of people who describe themselves as progressives are thinking about this issue a lot.
A lot of people our age are not having kids or waiting for very long, and they have like a great life regardless.
Emma Brennan and Lauren Wright got married recently. They live in a warehouse loft in Baltimore. They say they want kids, but the world often feels like a scary place to raise children. They worry about climate change, rising income inequality, and America's polarized politics.
It's really making me personally question, okay, do I really, really want this?
I feel like we have conversations about the state of the world, and I feel like we've seen a lot of change in our lifetime, not necessarily for good.
Yeah.
Wright and Brennan told us they are hearing leaders talk about parenting and falling birth rates, but those voices are mostly on the right.
That whole Trump thing, like, we'll give you a bunch of money or a few grand.
Under a program proposed by Trump and passed by the Republican-controlled Congress, the U.S. government will invest $1,000 for each baby born to American citizens during his term in office. And that's just one proposal. Conservatives have embraced a whole range of pro-natalist ideas, which advocate for having more babies with urgency. Here's Elon Musk speaking on Bill Maher's HBO show.
I just think we should be cautious about civilizational decline we have plummeting birth rates most places.
Yeah. But in our reporting, right, we found many progressive-leaning groups have stayed mostly silent on the policy debate around birth rate decline.
Many mainstream academics have also shied away from talking about this issue, at least publicly.
And some told us point blank they fear even talking about fertility decline could validate more extreme ideas. Ruth Bronstein is a sociologist at Johns Hopkins University who studies right-wing movements.
Because once we start talking about things as a crisis, it justifies all manner of emergency measures that often involves controlling people.
Bronstein does think shrinking families could affect everything from pension systems to the social fabric of communities. But for many on the left, Bronstein says hearing government officials talk about trying to increase birth rates raises fears about the prospect of coerced reproduction.
One of the defining documents of modern feminism is The Handmaid's Tale, the dystopian novel by Margaret Atwood made into a television series where women are forced to bear children to counter low birth rates.
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
Many groups on the right have proposed limits on reproductive rights, including bans on abortion. Others on the far right have voiced opposition to contraception or called for limits on divorce.
Bronstein thinks the debate over fertility rates in the U.S. is also being shaped by conservative fears about diversity and immigration.
We are now no longer a majority white Christian nation, and in some period of time, we'll no longer be a majority white population. And so that's one piece of the demographic change that I hear a lot about.
Many people we spoke to on the political left in the U.S. and in other countries told us this coding of low birth rates as a right-wing concern means progressives have stayed on the sidelines of the conversation for too long.
It's a problem that has been avoided by feminists.
Martina Llopo-Díaz is a sociologist at the Catholic University of Santiago in Chile, who describes herself as a progressive. She thinks it's long overdue for researchers like herself to face this demographic reality and come up with their own solutions and policy ideas.
from a very feminist perspective, everyone has the right not to have children, but also people have the right to have children and to parent in safe and sustainable environments.
But getting more feminists and other progressives, as well as academics, to engage the policy debate over birth rates may not be easy.
These things are all, you know, a tricky minefield.
Alice Evans is a researcher at King's College London who studies women's issues. She's working currently as a visiting professor at Stanford University. Evans thinks the debate over falling birth rates is being skewed by what she calls a troubling silence from many progressives.
If progressives don't want to talk about it and self-censor, etc., then no one is going to talk about things that might impact progressives.
Evans thinks there are important ideas on the left that might make it easier for women to choose more children, boosting gender equity, for example, so that women carry less of the burden of parenting, or expanding economic support for low-income families that want kids. She says progressives would need to offer incentives and aid big enough to offset the significant costs of parenting.
It could be in the form of housing, it could be in terms of, you know, bonuses on your pension, it could be a tax rebate. That benefit would need to be large enough to sort of say, okay, fine, I'll make this big costly investment.
Leslie Root, a researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder, thinks there is growing awareness on the political left that declining birth rates are a real challenge and that many families need help in the form of left-leaning policies like guaranteed paid parental leave.
Across the ideological spectrum, people have identified that maybe these are winning policies, right? That these are things that people want, that people maybe aren't able to have the children that they want to have.
We asked Emma Brennan and Lauren Wright, the couple in Baltimore, about this policy debate over shrinking families. They say affordability is one of their biggest concerns.
Hearing what some of our friends pay for daycare,
it's insane.
Is wild.
Universal pre-K would be awesome.
They are planning now for their first child, a personal choice that's scary but joyous.
I never really envisioned like having a baby with somebody until I met Lauren, and I was like, oh, this is the person I want to do it with.
I actually have a wonderful life that would be wonderful to bring a child into.
As their family grows, Brennan and Wright say they want to hear more ideas that might make life easier and less costly for people like them who want to have children. I'm Brian Mann.
And I'm Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18. Coming up, we've got our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer, then more news of the day from All Things Considered. We receive support from Bonner Eye Clinic, introducing Dr. Abby Spurr to their team at both locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, performing routine eye exams, assisting with post-op care after surgery, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly.
On today's date, January 12th, in 2005, my good friend Scott Gerling tells me of observing a northern hawk owl flying through the oak trees in his woods with a gray squirrel hanging from its talons. The northern hawk owl, like many of the winter owls of northern Minnesota, is one of those that comes down from up north and spends the winter down here in hopes of finding better feed for itself. And this one has done just that. Gray squirrels spend the nights, these cold winter nights, clustered in nests with several other gray squirrels, keeping warm by hanging out with some friends. And this one won't be coming home tonight.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Jitasa, providing bookkeeping, accounting, and CFO services exclusively to the nonprofit sector. Jitasa is committed to serving nonprofits who make the world a better place. JITASA.com. And from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Juana Summers. Iran's government is cracking down hard on massive nightly street protests. The security forces have now killed several hundred protesters. That's according to human rights groups. Meanwhile, President Trump keeps suggesting the U.S. may get involved. Here he is on Air Force One Sunday night.
We're looking at it very seriously. The military is looking at it. And we're looking at some very strong options.
For more, we're joined by NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez and national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, Juana.
Greg, I'll start with you. Tell us what the latest is on these protests.
Yeah, the Iranian security forces are using deadly force much more frequently in recent days. More than 500 Iranians have been killed now over the past 2 weeks. These are mostly protesters and some security force members. This is according to the human rights activists in Iran. They are based here in the U.S., but have monitors in Iran. Now, neither NPR nor other news organization can verify these figures because information is so fragmented from Iran right now. The government has shut down the internet for the past several days. We are seeing videos on social media, but very little solid information. Local journalists are restrained. Foreign journalists can't get into the country. And over the years, we've seen several outbursts of these large street demonstrations dating back really to 2009. The latest one erupted over miserable economic conditions, but now there are increasing calls to oust the regime. This may well be the biggest challenge to the Islamic government since it came to power in 1979.
And as we heard at the top, President Trump says he is looking at all sorts of options in Iran. Franco, what can you tell us about him?
Yeah, President Trump said Iran is starting to cross his red lines. But he did not say exactly what they're looking at. But he and his administration say they are weighing several different possibilities, including military and non-military options. And he said, after making earlier threats, that the leaders of Iran reached out, actually over the weekend, and want to negotiate. Now, his team is working on a meeting, but he also said they might have to act sooner if this violence that Greg is talking about continues. Trump's expected to meet with his national security team tomorrow about Iran. Iran actually has responded as well, warning that U.S. bases could be considered a legitimate target if the U.S. goes through with the strike. But Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt called those comments laughable today and said on Fox News that the regime is saying one thing publicly and saying something very different privately to the administration.
But is President Trump's goal really to protect protesters? I mean, he's not exactly known for fighting for human rights. What kind of deal is he seeking?
Yeah, he's definitely not known for fighting for human rights. But let's also remember that he did order military strikes on Syrian targets during his first administration in response to chemical attacks by the Assad regime. At that time, he talked about his red line being crossed as well and specifically cited the image of choking children. Now, today or this weekend, Trump also said he would talk with billionaire Elon Musk about possibly getting Starlink, Musk's satellite internet service, to help with communications in Iran. But what Trump really wants, and this is something he's wanted for a long time, is a deal that permanently prevents Iran from getting nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Franco, what kind of feedback is President Trump getting from Congress, U.S. allies, other countries in the Middle East?
Well, he's always bouncing ideas off his friends and allies. One close ally, Senator Lindsey Graham, for example, is urging Trump to kill, quote, kill the leaders of Iran who are killing protesters. Graham argued on Fox News that taking out the supreme leaders would lead to peace and a new day in the Middle East. Now, of course, other lawmakers have expressed caution about taking military action. We've also heard, Juana, from the exiled crown prince of Iran, who has called on Trump to intervene. Trump was asked if he'd meet with the crown prince by a conservative radio host, Hugh Hewitt. But Trump said it would not be appropriate right now to do that.
Mm. Greg, if we can, let's just take a step back here and talk about how Iran's leadership has become so vulnerable.
Yeah, Iran has really suffered this series of major setbacks in the past 2 years. First, among its proxy network in the region and now at home, it really starts, Juana, with the Hamas attack in Israel in October of 2023. Israel's harsh response decimated Hamas, which has been supported by Iran. And a year later, the fall of 2024, Israel delivered another powerful blow, this time to Hezbollah in Lebanon, which Iran also backs. Right after that, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad fled, removing another ally. Iran invested billions and used these groups to project power in the region. Suddenly, they're all gone or badly weakened. And then Israel and the U.S. teamed up and bombed Iran last June. They hit the nuclear facilities, but they also exposed the weakness of Iran's defenses. And now we're seeing these mass protests challenging the regime.
And Greg, what options does the Iranian leadership have at this point?
Well, they're limited and they're not good ones. The traditional playbook is to unleash the Revolutionary Guards to crush the protests. That worked previously. It may work again, but it doesn't address the fundamental grievances on living standards, and that will keep eroding any support the regime might have left. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is 86. He's been in power 37 years. He's been good at holding power, but he's failed to meet the day-to-day needs of Iranians.
NPR's Greg Myrie and Franco Ordonez, thanks to both of you.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Here's a post on GoFundMe that caught our eye today.
It reads, a 500-pound bear has been living underneath my home in Altadena for over a month, and it has caused tens of thousands of dollars in damage.
Ken Johnson wrote that message. We reached out to him but did not hear back. Last November, he caught a black bear tearing away mesh and squeezing through a small opening below his house in Los Angeles.
The situation was, quite frankly,
please don't do this,
unbearable. And to make matters worse, state wildlife officials were at a loss at how to remove Johnson's new roommate.
We felt so bad for him because the state agency wasn't able to help him. They don't know how to do this.
That is Ann Bryant, executive director of the Bear League. It's a nonprofit and specializes in safe bear evictions. They swooped in to help.
I've done a lot of them myself, and right now I'm 74 years old, and I'm still doing this.
According to Bryant, they do over 100 of these bear evictions every year, equipped with paintball guns carrying non-toxic ammunition. The first step, scope out the den.
You check out the area. Where did the bear go to get in? How many other openings are there for him to get out?
Step two, send a trained operative to sneak beneath the house and get behind the bear.
You try and scoot around under there, crawl around amongst the spiders and the mice that are always under crawl spaces.
Step three, fire away.
And then he started firing paintballs. So then that got the bear up, and he's like, what's that? And who are you, and what are you doing here?
Another volunteer on the outside of the house watched the entrance to the crawl space.
He sees this enormous head appear out of this small hole, and then the bear struggling and clawing and trying to get out.
Go, go, he's out, he's out, he's out!
The bear ran off. Then they boarded up the entrance and placed an electrified unwelcome mat in the openings. When the bear tried to return that night,
coming right back to that same opening, that was his claimed home, seeing the mat and not knowing what it is, and then stepping on it and jumping and backing away and running off.
With any luck, the bear will take a big pause before coming back again.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Coming up, we've got National Native News. That is the news from Kohanic Broadcast Corporation. We'll also bring you an hour from now, the latest Up North report. And at 6 o'clock, it is the news from Canada. It is as it happens. We're expecting a chance of mixed precipitation tonight. Steady temperatures in the low to mid 30s. South winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20 miles an hour. For tomorrow, Tuesday, chance of rain mixed with snow. Partly sunny to mostly cloudy. Highs 35 to 38. And then temperatures falling overnight from 3 to 10. Little cooler by Wednesday, but some sun. 11 to 17. And evening lows on Wednesday night, 5 below to 3 above. Tune in tomorrow for the Tuesday morning show. We'll bring you student phonology reports. We'll also talk with Pam Perry about birds. That's coming up at 8:40 tomorrow on the morning show. I'm Heidi Holton.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native community members in Minneapolis, Minnesota held a press conference Friday to discuss immediate needs, resources, and plans for community care following the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an ICE agent last week in the city. Members of Native organizations and grassroots groups have set up two hubs in Minneapolis for people to gather and organize. Members of the Native community are also conducting street patrols. Robert Lilligren is the president and CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors. He says the Native community does not feel safe with the federal presence, adding they're receiving reports of ICE interactions with Native people and detainment.
As a community, I know we are skilled at protecting our people, protecting our assets, protecting our non-Native people and their assets. And we've had to do this over and over again, historic.
Nikki Love is the executive director of the Tawahi Foundation and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors.
We're all here to keep each other safe. And it's very important that we think about not just as Native nations, but that's very important, right? But also as Native individuals, exercise our sovereign rights.
Leaders say they're working with Native organizations, grassroots groups, and tribal leaders to address the ICE presence in their community. Meanwhile, tribal leaders across the country are raising concerns about ICE activities and the safety of their tribal citizens, including leaders in South Dakota, after the detainment of tribal members in Minneapolis. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene has more.
A statement from the Office of President Frank Starr comes out of the Oglala Sioux Tribe says he is aware of reports of the detainment of four Oglala tribal members by ICE in Minneapolis. In the report, an Oglala bystander was able to get their tribal identities, but unable to get their names. In the statement, President Starr comes out writes, quote, "All Native people born within the territorial limits of the United States are recognized as U.S. citizens by birth. Because I'm both a tribal citizen and a U.S. citizen, ICE has no lawful authority to detain me." In another statement, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Chairman Steve Sitting Bear writes, quote, "Our nation is a sovereign government, and our members are not immigrants. We are not subject to immigration enforcement on our own lands." He goes on to say that ICE activity is not welcome or authorized on the lands of the Standing Rock Reservation, and that unauthorized personnel will be escorted from the reservation. South Dakota is not immune from the recent wave of immigration crackdowns, as immigration arrests and operations have been reported in communities across the state in recent months. I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
Last week, a former White Mountain Apache police officer in Arizona was arrested, stemming from a 15-count grand jury indictment alleging serial sexual abuse and kidnapping. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, federal law enforcement authorities are now asking for any additional victims to come forward.
Carl Eugene Leslie is accused of sexually abusing and kidnapping three victims while on duty between 2020 and 2023. All are White Mountain Apache, and one is a minor. FBI Phoenix Special Agent in Charge Heath Yonke thinks there's others.
We have to be careful, so I won't be able to talk a lot of specifics outside of what's in the actual indictment. What I can say is we believe there are more victims out there.
Leslie's nearly two-decade career ended in 2024.
There's no preclusion of a victim coming forward, no matter how far it may have gone back. We just need to know who they are and the facts behind that.
Leslie has been assigned an attorney out of Flagstaff who declined to comment. If convicted on all counts, he faces up to a life sentence and a $250,000 fine. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Tribal Development Partners, helping tribes build toward their goals through 105L leasing and essential facility development. Empowering sovereignty, strengthening community. More at tribaldevpartners.com, proud supporters of this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Rob Schmitz. Residents of the Twin Cities have been on edge for nearly a week after an ICE officer shot and killed Renee Macklin Good in Minneapolis last Wednesday. At least 2,000 federal immigration officers are now deployed in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and hundreds more are arriving this week. And today, the state, as well as the cities of both Minneapolis and St. Paul, announced they are suing Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and other federal immigration officials in an attempt to block that surge of officers. NPR's Meg Anderson is in Minneapolis to update us on what's been happening since the shooting happened. Meg, first, tell us about this new lawsuit.
Yeah, so the lawsuit alleges that the surge is, quote, driven by nothing more than the Trump administration's desire to punish political opponents and to sow fear in the community here. They also allege that the tactics of federal officers here have been unlawful and are creating dangerous and chaotic circumstances and making people afraid to leave their homes. And I've been hearing that a lot from community members as well.
Yeah, I grew up in the Twin Cities metro area, and my Facebook feed has lit up with concern. How would you describe the mood there in the Twin Cities?
Yeah, it is really tense here. People are afraid and unnerved at what feels like a military-style occupation of their city. There's also a sense of anger, too. Hundreds of community members have joined neighborhood watch groups. They're coordinating together to track federal immigration officers, sharing license plate information and the locations of those officers, and then observing them when they try to detain people. So when officers exit their vehicles, many of the observers are there nearly immediately, honking horns, blowing whistles, filming. Here's what that sounds like.
Wow, Meg, that sounds really tense.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And the sound you're hearing was a particularly tense exchange this afternoon in South Minneapolis. Immigration officers in a vehicle hit another car. I was there shortly after and could see that the back left side of the car was smashed in. My colleague Sergio Martinez Beltran and I interviewed the driver and his wife, who was in a separate car. They told us they're both U.S. citizens. They live in a northern suburb with their children. They were driving to drop off one of their cars at a mechanic and said the federal officers chased the husband, Christian Molina, before hitting him. His wife, Lorena Molina, says her husband was angry and didn't want to show his identification. She felt like she had to pacify the federal officers.
I was very scared, and so I felt like I had the need to talk to the officers and say, hey, please ignore whatever he's saying. Let him live and
Let him live, wow. She said. Yeah. So, and you know, after that, there was a standoff there between hundreds of protesters and dozens of federal officers. Those officers eventually used tear gas to disperse that crowd. They left without detaining anyone. NPR has reached out to ICE for comment, but we have not heard back.
So this sounds very tense on the ground, and observers are still showing up to confront ICE officers?
Yeah, they are. So an observer I spoke with, he asked not to be named because he fears for his safety for publicly criticizing the government, said the work has felt very dangerous. He's seen ICE officers driving erratically, speeding through intersections, hopping curbs. But he says, you know, the people who are watching, they're just normal people who care about their neighbors and want to protect them. And I should note, it's not illegal to film a federal officer or to make noise around them.
That's NPR's Meg Anderson. Meg, thank you.
You're welcome.
Who gets to be a parent today has been reshaped by increased access to IVF or in vitro fertilization. Today, a record number of single women in their 40s are using it to become moms, but this path is still new and it isn't easy for them. NPR's Paula Vigo-Goy brings us the story of one mom in Nashville, Tennessee, who's navigating this cultural shift.
Laura Terry was approaching her 40s when she gave herself an interesting present.
For my 39th birthday, I bought a vial of donor sperm, which is a kind of odd birthday gift to buy yourself, I suppose.
That was just the beginning for Terry, who's 44 and works at a top management consulting firm. She decided to start a family on her own through IVF. That's how she had her two daughters.
Oh, McDonald went to school.
Eleanor, who is now four.
And at her school, she learned. What did she learn?
And Margaret, who is two, they're a riot, creating their own nursery rhymes in their car ride to daycare.
Numbers.
Terry never really cared about having a partner. She got the idea of pursuing IVF from a book where the author wrote about her own journey.
I had never heard of being a single mom by choice before that. And it was like a light bulb went off.
That light bulb is going off for a lot of women at a time when more Americans than ever are single. The number of unmarried women over 40 who are having kids has grown by 250% in the last three decades. Still, Terry hesitated about becoming a single parent, especially after a friend told her it was a terrible idea. But she knew she wanted a family and she couldn't let go.
I'd started thinking about this idea. Something about my fertility is at risk.
So she went for it. But Terry was extremely anxious about how her family in Knoxville would react because it was an unfamiliar concept. She remembers the moment she broke the news to her parents. It was after Thanksgiving dinner in 2019.
I started crying as I was telling them this, that I really value our family and I want to have a family of my own.
The room felt heavy. There was a moment of stunned silence.
And then my dad looked at my mom and he says, "Joe, where's the champagne?"
That support was a huge relief for Terry. Her next task, choosing a donor. Top priorities, family health history, education, and that the donor looked somewhat like her.
I had a spreadsheet that was like 30 rows long and 30 columns wide.
Then she started getting ready for IVF. That process can be painful and complicated. She got her eggs retrieved, and then they were fertilized in a lab to make an embryo. Terry got pregnant on her first try.
I should be quite grateful for what my process was overall.
But not all women are as lucky. Many women have to try multiple times with no guarantee they will ever get pregnant. Plus, there's the price tag. Each try can cost as much as $30,000. It's why IVF is out of reach for many. Terry's was covered by her employer.
I am incredibly fortunate to have unbelievably good health benefits.
Which is quite rare. Only one in four companies offer such benefits. Terry faces all the challenges of being a single mom. On top of that, she often feels the burden of having to explain her family. When she moved into her new home in Nashville, a neighbor asked what her husband did for work. She answered, "They're a family of a mom with two kids."
And he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Was he sorry I didn't have a husband? I still don't know to this day. But there's very much like a moment of feeling other and different.
Other and different. Terry worries her two daughters could also feel that way.
One of her classmates said, "Hey, Eleanor, is that your mom?" And she said, "Yes." And then he said, "Well, where's your dad?" And Eleanor just froze in that moment.
But such moments don't preoccupy her all the time. Terry loves being a mom and is amazed by the power of touch and how holding her kids close can calm them. Not to mention the joy of singing with them.
I love the curtains. I love the blocky box.
Pallavi Gugoy, NPR News.
You can find more on this story and other single moms on NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The holidays are over, the decorations are packed away, and what's left is a long stretch of winter. For some people, this quieter season can bring a sense of calm. For others, it can feel isolating. So how do you find connection when the invitations slow down and the days feel short? NPR Life Kit host Mariel Segarra has tips on how to grow your community any time of the year.
Last year, Priya Parker posted on Instagram the obituary of a man in New Orleans named Pablo Johnson. He would host these Monday night dinners where he cooked red beans and rice and invited neighbors, friends, and even strangers to his table. Thousands of people over many years. Parker says in response to her post, people kept saying to her, "I wish I was invited to a dinner like that."
And I'm thinking, host one, host one, host it. And I think right now, everybody's longing for community. We long to be part of a village. We long to have people come over and help us. But when's the last time you've hosted something? When's the last time you have helped somebody move? When's the last time you picked somebody up at the airport? It's almost like community has become consumption instead of production.
Parker thinks about community and relationships a lot. She wrote a book called The Art of Gathering. And her first tip for building a village is to host something you're excited or curious about. One woman who wrote to her based a whole gathering on a tomato tart recipe that she wanted to make.
She invited six friends to come over that week for dinner. She made the tomato tart. She had everyone dress up in red. And then at the dinner, she asked, "What made you feel like a tomato this week?"
So some questions to ask yourself if you're trying to come up with an idea for a gathering.
Well, how do I want to spend my time? Or what's one activity I've been wanting to do? Or what is one thing I've been longing for? It could be simply like, I've been dying to go and check out the new bookshop across town. Maybe invite three friends to come with me. Let's go for a little field trip. Start with something that like you feel like, that sounds fun.
And if you don't have a lot of people to invite, go small. One or two guests, maybe a family member or a neighbor. You can also start meeting people to invite to things at community events and institutions.
Start showing up. Start becoming a regular. There's so many third places that want to be this for people. So restaurants, bookshops, gyms, parks that are wanting to bring people together.
When you're brainstorming where to go and what to do, pay attention to what makes you feel more alive. One of Parker's friends was missing playing kickball, which she used to do on the playground as a kid. So she organized a game.
And like 20 people showed up. They were so delighted, in part because she was so excited.
Now, if you do want to host something, it can help to have one or two cornerstone friends, people who are reliable, who you love being around, who you know will show up, and who are game to try new things.
My husband and I have a term for these people. We call them yes friends. They're friends who always say yes. Yes, I'll do that thing with you. Yes, I'll come over. Yes, you know, I'm down.
And to take some pressure off yourself, allow your friends to share the joy and responsibility of hosting with you. Maybe you and a friend co-host a community dinner. Or maybe it's just that when your guests show up, you let them be useful. Give them some veggies to mince. Tell them you're responsible for tonight's playlist. We are talking about building a village after all. And when you're part of a village, you don't have to do it all alone. For NPR News, I'm Mariel Segarra.
For more tips, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:48 and we're listening to All Things Considered, the news of the day from National Public Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. We are independent, 50 years old almost, as of April 23rd, KAXE, the first rural public radio station in the nation, and we're glad you're joining us today. You can tune into the Season Watch pod this week. We brought you a conversation with one of the teachers in the Phonology Network, Chad Kaditz from Little Falls. You can check it out at our webpage, kaxe.org, or on podcast platforms. And we're planning an event, KBXE presenting Skipalooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji, Saturday, January 24th from noon to 3. Come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. Bring some food to share for a potluck. We received support from Sanford Bemidji Joe Lucan Cancer Center, providing health and healing in a local setting. More at sanfordhealth.org. Check out KAXE.org. You can find a lot of information, including stories about our album of the week, Secret Love, by the band Dry Cleaning. We've also got a story about how flu is hitting northern Minnesotans amid high rates across the nation. Some other things happening in our region. Hibbing Public Utilities has a town hall meeting tonight at 6 o'clock in the Little Theater of the Hibbing Memorial Building. They're going to be providing important information about recent lead testing results and their efforts to reduce lead exposure in the community. And going on, Happy Dancing Turtle continues their Winter Bingo scavenger hunt until January 15th. Look for 24 items on the Winter Bingo card with a special focus on animal tracks. Chance of mixed precipitation tonight, steady temperatures in the low to mid 30s. That continues tomorrow with highs 35 to 38, but overnight temperatures falling 3 to 10 above.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Rob Schmitz. Nearly 15,000 nurses in New York City went on strike today. Included in their list of demands, higher wages, protections from understaffing, and tighter security due to recent attacks at hospitals. The work stoppage impacts staff at New York Presbyterian, Montefiore Medical Center, and the Mount Sinai Health System, some of the largest providers in the city. All are privately run. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has declared a state of emergency. It is the second time in the last 3 years that the nurses have joined the picket line, and union officials say it's the largest nursing strike in New York City's history. One of those officials joins us now. Nancy Hagans is the president of the New York State Nurses Association. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Nancy, your union is asking for higher wages, and of course, most labor disputes boil down to money. What is the current average salary of a nurse in New York, and what is the union now asking for?
Okay, and I need to make a correction. Our union are asking for safe staffing, because safe staffing saves lives. What we asking is for patient-nurse ratios to be better, because what we gained 3 years ago, management wants to take away. We also asking for workplace violence protection, because as you know, it has been a rampage. And last week, Thursday, there was an active shooter at New York Methodist, which belonged to NYP in Brooklyn, New York. And we also asking for fair wages. Wages, we would negotiate, but patient care, we will not cut corners. I know the media reporting that management is saying that we're asking for 40%, which is false, because the CEO of NYP this last year made $23 million. His two-day salaries is more than what nurses make in a year.
Now, that's a lot for a CEO, but I want to go back to my first question, Nancy. What is the average annual salary for a nurse in New York City, and what more is the New York, is your union asking for?
Our average salary is, I would say, about $125,000, $130,000. We put a proposal. The way wages are being asked, a proposal is across the table, and we would negotiate wages. As nurses, our top priorities are patient safety, working violence protection, benefits, that includes proper medical coverage, because as nurses, we get hurt a lot. We are exposed to everything during the height of the pandemic. We went to work without PPE, without proper protection, while our CEOs were home playing golf.
Right.
What we're asking is a fair wage that could be negotiated. Right now, we are not going to cut corners when it comes to patient care.
So in a statement, Joe Salmanis, a spokesman for Montefiore Einstein Hospital, called your union's demands, quote, irresponsible. He said if the union gets its way, it'll cost $3.6 billion. He included that it would be a nearly 40% wage increase. You've already said that that's not true. He said you're putting patients at risk. How do you respond to these accusations?
Mm-hmm. This executive is a hypocrite, because last year he made $8 million. If he really wanted to protect patients, the $100 million he bragged so loud about that he used to replace our frontline workers. He should take that $100 million, invest it into our communities, invest it toward nurse-to-patient ratio, invest it toward our medical coverage, invested toward a pension. Nurses did not go out on strike. Management put nurses on strike. We sat there every day to negotiate. They would come in for 10, 15 minutes and leave. We stayed every day. Management would not show up. We came with mediators. They only showed up for 15 minutes and said they are not moving. NYP have said, New York Presbyterian, they want to take away all our medical coverage. It's too expensive. But it's not too expensive for them to spend over $200 million to bring in replacement nurses that are not as qualified as us. For someone who made $7 million and sit in an office, he has a lot of nerve.
That is Nancy Hagans, president of the New York State Nurses Association. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, today, we wanted to remember a prolific television and film composer.
Guy Moon, who helped compose scores and soundtracks for numerous animated and live-action films, has died. In a statement posted on social media, his family says he died in a traffic collision.
Moon is best known for his work on a number of animated kids' shows on Nickelodeon and Cartoon Network, including The Fairly Odd Parents and Danny Phantom.
He's here to fight for me and you.
He composed these beloved songs for the Fairly Odd Parents, like the standout My Shiny Teeth and Me.
Moon regularly collaborated with Butch Hartman, the executive producer and creator of both shows. In 2019, Moon appeared on Hartman's podcast, Speech Bubble, and talked about his process.
Well, with Fairly Odd Parents, since it was our first show, I just went with my instinct. And I would say if there's any style of music that is Fairly Odd Parents, it's kind of a big band jazzy kind of thing.
Moon said he drew inspiration for his scoring style from Carl Stalling, who composed music for the Warner Brothers cartoon classic, The Looney Tunes. Here's Moon again on Hartman's podcast.
I think that's one thing that you liked about my work is I kind of followed his. If there was something happening on camera that was sequential, the music would go right along with it. Just as if Bugs Bunny was prancing across the screen and you heard a boop, 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 boop.
In addition to his work on these beloved animated shows, Moon also contributed to scores and soundtracks for a number of live-action films and TV shows over the years.
But it's his long creative partnership with Butch Hartman that cemented his place in the hearts of so many. In a long tribute on social media, Hartman remembers Moon as his friend and brother, someone whose, quote, amazing attitude, kindness, warmth, and overall sense of fun were evident from the moment they met.
Hartman says Moon scored every episode of The Fairly Odd Parents and Danny Phantom, even when both shows were airing at the same time. This is how gifted people do things, Hartman writes. They make it look easy to us mere mortals.
Guy Moon died last week. He was 63 years old.
When I'm feeling lonely, sad as I can be, all by myself in an uncharted island in an endless sea. What makes me happy fills me up with glee. Those bones in my jaw that don't have a flaw, my shiny teeth and me. My shiny teeth that twinkle just like the stars in space. My shiny teeth that sparkle, adding beauty to my face.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. This is NPR.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. We've got another hour ahead of All Things Considered here on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Our thanks goes out to you, our listener supporters, as well as the businesses like Bemidji Brewing, located at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events like Tropical Escape Week featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Coming up at 6 o'clock, the news from Canada, It Is As It Happens. Then at 7 o'clock, we are on the river with DJ the DJ. Our question of the week, we want to know about your favorite games. You can text us 218-326-3300.